Hello, everyone. My name is Ronan Levy, and I'd like to welcome you to the very first episode of A Good Long Podcast, my podcast exploring the lessons for what it means and how to live a good long life. Now, if you've made it this far into the episode, you'll know this conversation is going to touch on something that honestly scares the living shit out of me, getting cancer at a ridiculously young age. Why on earth would you start a podcast about longevity talking about early onset cancer, Ronan? You may be asking yourself. Well, one of the things that I learned recently is that the desire to experience novelty is actually a predictor of longevity. So in homage to that fact, this episode has been consciously selected to be our first, because if talking about cancer on a longevity podcast isn't novel, at least it's unexpected. And when you hear our guest's story today, you're going to find that there's a lot more unexpected about her too. Our guest today is Florence Schaefer. I had the privilege of meeting Florence a year ago at the Intelligent Change Summit, and then again at the Brain Mind Summit in September in San Francisco. Florence is a technology executive who has led digital transformation for notable brands globally. Her work sits at the intersection of technology, innovation, design, and people. Her 20 plus years of experience spans multiple industries and cultures, including beauty, luxury fashion, automotive, film, real estate and construction, healthcare, and hospitality and food in New York, Hong Kong, Los Angeles, the San Francisco Bay Area, Nepal, Paris, and Chicago, respectively. Most recently, Florence launched a new company called Becoming, a holistic wellness concierge service where Florence and her team have woven together global wisdoms and scientific breakthroughs to craft personalized programs for optimal life performance. I had the privilege to be one of Becoming's first beta testers, and I can say it's a truly magical experience. And when you listen to this conversation with Florence, you'll know that notwithstanding the fact that her cancer diagnosis came literally the day before we departed for the retreat, she very much practices what she preaches. Hope you enjoy this conversation and find some inspiration in Florence's story and her lovely energy. Thanks for coming on. So this is the first podcast I've done in probably 6 or 7 months, so it's probably going to be rusty and a little awkward, and I apologize for it, but I'm hoping that your charm and smooth talking is going to overcome my inability and awkwardness. Okay, so no pressure whatsoever.
I was about to say, no pressure on my part. Good. Perfect.
Yeah. And so like the broad theme, so as you may have seen from my invite, the podcast is called A Good Long Podcast. The podcast recordings aren't going to be that long, but the general theme is like exploring what it takes to lead a good and hopefully long life. So like documenting the wisdom, because there's a lot of people who are out there trying to tell you everything and so many things to do. And it feels like there's a lot of knowledge and not a whole lot of wisdom. And I feel like you've had enough experiences in your life to translate a lot of your experiences of knowledge and translate that into wisdom. And certainly, you know, as you're navigating the things you're navigating now, I'm, like I said last time, I'm in awe in how you're handling it all. And would love to talk about that too, if you're cool with it.
Absolutely. Well, thank you. I feel like that's a very nice way to say, I've definitely failed a lot and learned a lot.
there was no implications. I feel like, I know that's a good way to learn. You know, Erwin, the teacher I work with, talks about like in our struggle, we've learned to glorify, or sorry, in our society, we've learned to glorify struggle, right? Like the only things that are worthwhile, the things you have to struggle for. And he's like, why is that? Like it really is a perverse outcome. Like why can't we appreciate the things that come easily more, yeah, right? Because if you think about it naturally, we should. It came easily. It came elegantly. Why can't we appreciate that more than the things that we had to suffer for? It doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but it's so deeply ingrained in our society that, you know, struggle equals value. And I don't know why.
Yeah. I mean, that resonates with me deeply. As you know, my mom is Korean. So, yep. And, you know, immigrant parents, I think that's something that was really embedded in me from an early age. I wouldn't even say necessarily consciously, but this idea, I always used to laugh because I felt like if you had given me two roads, both leading to the exact same destination, one is, you know, straight up this hill, straight up a mountain, and the other one's just sort of this breezy path next to a lake, I probably would have taken the mountain every single time, right? Based on sort of my mental learnings of somehow that was going to make it more worthwhile or maybe in that case, it would feel more like an accomplishment.
Yeah, you have to prove yourself, right? Like, it's like, oh, I can do that.
Somehow I don't deserve it if I didn't struggle through it, right? It's actually something I've been thinking a lot about given my most recent situation and all the different things that have happened. Mm. It's really shifting to this idea of effortless flow. And what does that mean? And looking at, well, why do we feel that everything has to be hard? Or why do we look for those moments? And what if we flipped it? What if we looked at creating more space in our lives? What if we looked at actually what is the easier path to get there?
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
That's a deep conversation, but before we get there, and I wrote it down so we can come back to it. So I'll probably forget, but I wrote it down, so I won't forget. But actually, I just want to learn all of your story because I don't know much of it. So you're of a Korean mother and a Jewish father. Is that correct?
No. So
because it's a very Jewish last name.
It is. We're German, I guess. So the other side.
Okay.
So I grew up of a South Korean mother and a South Dakotan father. That's what I like to say. Yes. And I would say that the South is probably the only commonality between those two cultures.
Yeah.
So it was phenomenal getting raised by sort of these two, you know, very resilient human beings that had very similar values, but really their backgrounds could not be more different, and sort of their upbringings, expectations from family. And by the time they met, they were almost in their 40s, which back in the 70s is a very unusual thing to be single still.
Yeah. Yeah. Also having kids at that age, presumably.
Absolutely. Exactly. Yeah. My sister and I were born. My mom did not even occur to her that she might not be able to have kids. So that just shows you how she's the type of person who she just wants to do something. She just goes and does it.
That's super cool. So your dad's from South Dakota, and from a cultural perspective, it's like, did they have their own styles? Like when you were dealing with your dad, it was one thing. And when you're dealing with your mom, it was a totally different style, or did they manage to blend that into kind of a common upbringing experience?
Yeah, I think they definitely had their very different hearts in our upbringing. I think we thought of dad as sort of the cerebral, very calm. Nothing could faze the man. I look back and I think he was just, nothing upset him. He was always just able to kind of see the bigger picture and kind of navigate things. My mom, definitely the more passionate, sometimes, you know, a bit more volatile in sort of her expression of emotions. And I think through her also very entrepreneurial. So she was the one we would go to. My dad worked, my mom was at home. So it was really kind of, she was the more formative one, I think, if you think about the culture we were raised under. And it took me quite some time. We grew up in California, so there's a decent mix of cultures that we're surrounded by. And it wasn't until I was older that I realized actually I felt more Korean than American in many different social situations. And navigating that was really interesting.
Can you explain that?
Yeah. So I think one thing that I found really interesting is that the level of self-confidence I received and my sister received from my mother was very deep-rooted. It kind of comes back to what we were just talking about, this idea that your abilities and your success is really linked back to your dedication and your hard work. And so there is almost an assumption that you are worthy, that you have what it takes. You know, there's a lot of emphasis on really being supportive and sacrificing for the family and being there to make sure that your kids have what they need. And so both my parents were very much like that, very family oriented. But it was interesting in high school, I remember being very surprised at some of the insecurities that the other girls had. And I didn't really fully understand it until I started understanding some of the rhetoric around this and this idea of them being more, being told that they weren't good at certain things or that they weren't pretty enough or that they weren't this enough. There was a lot of certain enough, right? And so I felt always a lot of gratitude to my parents for always giving us that kind of foundation where we just felt that no matter what, right, we were going to be supported as we're navigating our journey. There's always a flip side of the coin, right? So the other side of that is that if we didn't do well, then it was of our own doing or our own lack of doing. So, you know, it's really interesting to see how those mental models that we have really end up shaping us.
Right. And what did you think about like the other girls in particular at the time? What do you think that they were being told, or where was that message coming from? If you have any idea, I know I'm asking you to speculate there.
Yeah. What I remembered was it was a lot around looks.
Right.
And there was a lot of pressure around what people had or didn't have, whether it was which color your hair was, you know, are your eyes a certain way? Is your figure a certain way? You know, especially, you know, did you have breasts or not? I remember one girl pointing out to me, we were in a play. And so we were all changing, and she pointed at me and she says, "Ha ha! Look, everybody, Florence doesn't have any breasts." And I remember looking over at her and thinking, "Why does she care about my breasts? What a weird thing!" And I was 15, and I realized that is not the normal response of somebody being made fun of for not having any breasts, right? And so I think it was in these exchanges that my friend said, "Are you okay?" I said, "Okay about what?" And she said, "Well, she was making fun of you." And I said, "Is that what that was?" Because I just didn't understand why she was interested in some part of my body that really has nothing to do with her.
Right.
So again, like there was just these very unusual interactions I had that to me didn't make any sense.
That's fascinating. It's fascinating to me because, again, taking it out of the context of even the gender conversation about men and women, mm-hmm. you know, you look at the sort of personal growth that a lot of people go through. And it feels, at least the narrative has been woven in to some degree in our society, that learning to deal with that stuff, taking those punches, getting the lumps and bruises, and then getting to the other side, which happens usually sometime around 40, when you're just like, "Oh, I don't give a shit about what other people say to me," but like, that's part of the journey, is having to suffer through it and then emerge the other side to get to the realization, that it doesn't really matter. But it seems like it kind of got embedded in you at a young age. Were you able to maintain that? Cause just by way of comparison, my wife Stephanie tells a story about when she first went to school. You know, I don't remember all the details, so I'm paraphrasing, but she got there and, oh no, it wasn't when she first went to school. I think it was when like they were doing like inoculations at school back in the day when they did inoculations at school. And like all the girls were crying and she was looking around being like, "Oh, I guess I'm supposed to cry too." And she started crying accordingly, just because that was the social context and she responded to that. But she wasn't defaulted into thinking that particular moment was supposed to be bad or scary or whatever. Mm. Have you been able to maintain that, or did you kind of default into the more, I guess, traditional Western patterns of like, "Oh, I should be really worried about how my body looks or what people are saying to me," as you kind of emerge from that state, that period of life?
Yeah. When you were asking me, my mind really went to this one story where I was in my 20s, and I remember I was living in LA, and I was at a dinner with some friends, and this would happen often, is my girlfriends would point out that I wasn't eating very much, which I thought was very strange because I've always been the same size, ate very consistently. There was, you know, sort of nothing concerning about my eating habits, but they would point this out consistently. And it was so interesting because I'd be full,
right?
But I would force myself to eat more because I didn't want that attention. And so what was funny is I remember feeling like I was always a few pounds overweight, not to my own devices, but actually just to placate the people around me.
Right.
And it took me probably 5+ years to stop doing that. I remember one day I was like, I think it was when I moved to Europe, and nobody said that to me. And I thought, well, this is freeing. I was like, I can actually eat the amount that I want to eat and not have people watching over me and judging me. And it didn't occur to me that this was a way to divert attention from what was happening. And actually somebody pointed out to me that a lot of my really close girlfriends are Asian and Indian, and they're very supportive. And it's very funny. It's a very different, maybe again, like this is where it's so interesting, the cultural upbringing or just sort of what you're comfortable with, right? We have a lot of the same conversations around just having parents who are very strict and expecting a lot from us. And that this is where I learned that sort of managing other people's emotions. We were always more concerned about, well, how is the other person going to take my performance? How is the other person going to take sort of my actions? How do they feel about how I look? How do I make them feel comfortable? And it was really this continued focus on sort of that pleasing or that sort of external performance versus, wait a second, that I don't care about that. So it's interesting to not be really moving from that internal locus of control. And Ronan, you and I have spoken about that is a lot of the work that I've been doing and you did with my teams prior was really looking at how do we clarify that difference and understand what is really the thing that we care about? Where are we coming from? And sort of how do we want to make decisions that are really aligned to our desired life path?
Yeah. It reminds me a couple of years ago, I had this realization that I think if I could wave a magic wand and do one thing that would improve the state of the world, it would be to teach people to mind their goddamn business, right? Like, what does it matter how much you're eating or not, right? Yeah, you know, so much of, I think, our social struggles is because people have opinions and attitudes towards other people's things. And, you know, this goes back to some of the philosophy of law stuff. But at the end of the day, it's like, if I'm not harming you, if what I'm doing has no direct impact on you, then you have no right to comment on it. You know, it's like Oliver Wendell Holmes is known of saying, like, your right to swing your fists ends where my nose begins. And you know, that's in the physical context, but in the metaphysical and in the emotional and the spiritual realms, it should be just as equally applicable, being like, just stay out of my way and mind your business, right? If I ask for your input, then give it. Otherwise, please don't comment, right? It's very interesting.
And I think another way to look at it is, you know, they say suffering is really often from a point of comparison or expectation, right?
Yeah.
And I think if we look to remove two of those things from our lives, life just gets easier, right?
Yeah.
So back to that effortless flow of, well, why do we have to ascribe certain things as difficult or not the way it should be, right? Should being a very
loaded word.
Yes, very loaded word.
Yeah, no, it's funny too, because like, I mean, a couple of thoughts that came up just before earlier today, I was reading The Wisdom of Insecurity by Alan Watts, trying to get inspired to ask some profound questions of you if they didn't sort of come out naturally. Anyway, there's this one paragraph that I set aside that feels germane, which is, consequently, our age is one of frustration, anxiety, agitation, and addiction to the quote unquote dope. Somehow we must grab what we can while we can and drown out the realization that this whole thing is futile and meaningless. This dope we call our high standard of living, a violent and complex stimulation of the senses, which makes them progressively less sensitive and thus in need of yet more violent stimulation. We crave distraction, a panorama of sights, sounds, thrills, and titillations into which as much as possible must be crowded in the shortest possible time. And then you're on to say, to keep up this standard, most of us are willing to put up with lives that consist largely in doing jobs that are a bore, earning the means to seek relief from the tedium by intervals of hectic and expensive pleasure. These intervals are supposed to be the real living, the real purpose served by the necessary evil of work. So on that very positive note, let's talk about your career. actually, it was a transition that I was going to make, because a lot of what you're sharing, I feel like, is you know, profoundly wise and from experience and probably some degree of suffering along the way. And I find it interesting because it does to me reflect a level of wisdom and intuition that much of your career path, at least looking at LinkedIn, would be arguably countervailing to, right? Like, you worked in high fashion for quite a while, which seems to be a source of the exact opposite of wisdom and security, and instead is motivated by greed and insecurity. How did that happen?
Yeah, it's fascinating you point that out, because I've worked in so many different industries and I realized that there's a lot of commonalities, right? Just about just being human within each of those industries really, if independent of the terminology, the experiences in each of the places were very similar. Okay. So at the end of the day, people are still people. Creativity is creativity, and business models are very much business models. So, the way I ended up there, I was working in a startup in San Francisco.
Okay.
And I was, it was in Y Combinator. We were about a year and a half in, and I was very close to burnout. So I said, okay, I'm going to get it to the next stages, but I really need to take a break. I remember being at a lunch with my boyfriend at the time, and I basically couldn't say words. That's how just I was. And you've known me, words are not usually a problem, but I remember sitting there and I just couldn't come up with words. I had been working so hard, and I thought, okay, I need to take a break. And at that time, when I took a step back, I thought, well, where, you know, I'm a huge fan of taking away all the limitations and saying, well, let's just redesign this. If I could go anywhere, what would I want to do? And I really wanted to get more international experience. So I moved to Hong Kong without a job and just said, I'm going to find something.
Cool.
So I reached out to anybody and everybody who I was connected to on LinkedIn for a coffee. And I started just understanding the landscape there. And within a few weeks, I ran into a woman that I had met while working at the startup. She had been relocated from the Silicon Valley to Burberry in Asia. And she said, well, would you be interested in doing digital and technology at Burberry? Because you're very into fashion. You enjoy fashion. And I said, well, what does that mean? What does that mean to do technology in fashion? So she, you know, she took me through it, and I said, you know what, this would be really, really fun. And for me, it was a really wonderful time on a couple of different angles. One is that I left the Silicon Valley because I felt like it was not allowing me to be my whole self. I wore a skirt to a meeting once, and this guy gave me a probably 5-minute soliloquy about how we have fought for feminism so that I didn't have to wear a skirt. And I said, I'm not really sure how those things equate. I'm wearing a skirt because I like the skirt, not because I feel oppressed by the, you know, masculine race. Yeah. And so I just thought, well, goodness, I can't even just dress the way I want to in the Silicon Valley without being, without a bunch of assumptions. At the time, I felt like there was an assumption that if I cared about fashion, it meant I wasn't intellectual. And so that was when I really started to feel constrained. And when I moved to Asia, I did have this thought, like I'm a very inclusive person. And I said, does working in luxury fashion really mesh with that value system? And what I found in the company is not only is that company full of people who are some of the most kindest, really just family-oriented people I had ever met. It was very much very, very connected, community-oriented. Just some of my favorite friends that I've ever met were through my time there. But it was really, the company was really designed in a way where the creativity was at the core. And I think that was what, I had a similar experience at Lucasfilm. Okay. And when a company has such a strong creative presence, there's just a very different way that the company feels and flows. And I think that's what I felt so inspired by, is really that creativity. And I think that's what I felt day to day more than the business models or maybe sort of the messaging that goes outward. But I think if you talk to any of these creatives, there's just such a desire to bring beauty into the world in just such a simple way.
Right. A couple of points there. One was when you were mentioning the story about wearing a skirt to a meeting. One of the things, obviously, my lived experience is very different than yours, just based on sex, gender.
No skirts.
But one of the things that has already kind of always kind of confounded me about a lot of, you know, what I call suffrage movements is even though I recognize it's probably not the underlying actual drive, it feels like a lot of time it's like trying to establish equality with men, white men specifically, but men. And the more I've kind of zoomed out and looked around, I see like, why would you want to be playing in this game, right? Why would you want to be equal in this game? This game actually sucks. Like, what you're fighting for is not actually what you're striving for. Now, I understand that the narrative, the underlying core message is probably more along the lines of, I'm not fighting for equality in your game. I'm fighting for the freedom to do whatever I want. But a lot of it gets expressed, you know, I know this is a long time ago, but we think about like fashion in the 80s and what women were wearing who could do it all, have like the mother and the professional life and like the shoulder pads and all that kind of stuff. I'm like, you look back and you're like, what on earth were you thinking? Now that's with the benefit of hindsight and wisdom and experience and whatever. But a lot of the times I look around at like that, a lot of these movements, and I'm just like, the goal is not to be a better player in the game that exists. Mm-hmm. I don't think. I think it's to move to a different game altogether. Like, I've always been an entrepreneur. I look at what all the other companies are doing, and I'm like, I don't know. And maybe it's just my inherent insecurities, but like, I can't compete with you in your game. So I'm just going to start a new game and play over here. And that's much easier because now I get to set my own rules. Anyway, that was just a thought that came up when you were talking about the experience of being in that meeting and just being like, oh, I'm just wearing this dress, you know, the skirt, because I like it, not because I feel like I have to be something. It's an interesting complex.
No, I agree. And your explanation around the game is something I've thought about a lot, because when I was at Burberry in New York, we had International Women's Day, and my executives, I was on the executive team there, and my executives and the head of HR asked me to speak on a panel. And I said, what would I speak about? And they said, well, being a woman in tech. And I said, until you said that to me, I never thought of myself as a woman in tech. They said, really? And I said, yeah, I don't know why, but I've always had a lot of support from all of my male colleagues, or I just, maybe I didn't, and I didn't even notice because I was just busy doing my thing. But you know, I said, I'm happy to speak, but I just don't know what I would speak about. And they convinced me to be on the panel. And one of the things that I learned, because I love these conversations, they help me understand what I am not seeing. And they asked me, well, what do you do when you're in this situation and somebody speaks to you in a certain way, or somebody treats you in a certain way, where they're dismissing you? And I said, well, that's really interesting, because I don't know if that's really happened, because they might have been dismissing me, but really I wouldn't give them the power to dismiss me, right? So if I'm assuming that they're dismissing me because I'm a woman, or if I identify myself as a woman, or identify this, then of course I'm going to then respond in a way that acts as if I'm dismissed. And then it's almost creating this cycle of this dynamic between us that's only going to create more extreme sort of interactions that actually push us into this very kind of area of tension. And I said, instead, what I often think about, and maybe it is because I grew up between two cultures, is that they're playing the game that they know. They were raised in a certain construct, and the things that they're asking me or the things that they're questioning are based on their set of knowledge and their mental models. So if they say something to me and they say, well, I don't get that, or that doesn't make any sense, I'm taking it for what they're saying. They're saying it doesn't make any sense to them. Okay, well, let me explain like how I'm thinking about it. It doesn't mean it's right or wrong, but here's how it makes sense to me. And so it was through that conversation that I started to realize, well, actually part of the reason that I didn't feel dismissed or identified is because I realize that we all often come from just different angles, and we're trying to find that commonality to have the conversation, and understanding what is the set of rules and what is the game that you're playing, and then deciding, do I want to play this game? And like you said, Ronan, if I don't want to play this game, or if this is not my game, let me find a different game that I want to play. But that doesn't mean that that game doesn't have a right to exist. That's right. Just not the game I want to be in.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think you touch on something that I've thought a bit about recently, and it came up on the Honestly podcast with Barry Weiss. They had, mm-hmm. I don't remember the author's name, but she was talking about how, and Jonathan Haidt is another person who speaks about this, about like the lens of trauma. Everything is now viewed through the lens of trauma, right? And if you're expecting it, you know, and if you're looking at the circumstances of an event through the lens of trauma, you're always going to find some sort of trigger, some sort of microaggression or anything along those lines. But using the example you just gave, it's like, if you didn't know the circumstances in which to be dismissed, you would never be dismissed, right? It's a bit of a victim mentality of like, oh, you dismissed me. It's like, well, if I don't know what being dismissed is, I can't be dismissed, because, you know, it's all my own interpretation of the circumstances now. And it's a little bit more complex than that, but, sure. And so it's like a perfect example of being like, oh, I don't know. Did they dismiss me? I don't know. I just kept doing what I was there to do, and, and I wouldn't relent. And so I think that's a very interesting example about the importance of like the narratives we tell ourselves, right? Or we're told about the circumstances of the world. It's like, going back to Watts, it's like everything just is, and whatever we want to attach to it, whatever words we want to attach to it, we can, and that creates consequences, but we don't have to attach those words to it at all.
Absolutely.
The other question I was going to go to was, even though the people you were working with in, you know, these high fashion industries were lovely people, and I'm sure they were, was there an awareness of, you know, I think how the rest of the world views high fashion and just like the ugliness, you know, beauty, there's a lot of beauty in it, don't get me wrong, but it's kind of like, feels like a superficial beauty at the expense of all the ugliness that goes with it. And again, I'm just leveraging some of my wife's, you know, stories, as because she was a fashion model back in the day, and just how ugly the industry was on so many levels. Was there an awareness of that?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think Burberry is an interesting use case, because if you think about it, they were very on the forefront of understanding trends, right? They were one of the first to really have fashion that celebrated and had models that were LGBTQ. So, right. You know, and these sorts of things. So I think they were very good about staying culturally relevant in the way that they thought of themselves as, you know, they are who they are. So not pretending, it is about aspiration, right? That's what luxury is. It's about an aspirational, a desire to belong in this sense. Is there a dark side of that? Of course, always. And I think that, you know, we have seen this in the last, you know, at least 5 years plus, is just how do we start to bring in different models of human beings into even just the modeling world, right? We've seen a huge shift in the type of models to represent more of what's out there. You know, I think it's interesting, where is the responsibility lie, right? Is it the companies? Is it the creatives? Is it just about having the conversations? You know, so much of what leads us is, I would say, incentives and business models and how things are crafted. And we are pretty far from, I think, pure in designing those business models in such a way that we can get to the future we want to see. If we look at sort of the types of products, the companies, the services that have been built, they are often built to serve a business model that allows, you know, investors, shareholders, all of us in the ecosystem to be able to make more money. And so now if we step back and we said, well, instead of just being in response to this system, if we were to design the system or design pockets of the system based on the future we want to see, how different would that look? And I'm hopeful that some of the advancements that we're making across different technology advancements, across some of these things, will start to take that into consideration. And a lot of the people I talk to are really trying to devise more conscious businesses, business models, incentives that also are sustainable, right? It's not again, money's not evil. Capitalism's not evil. I'm not saying any of these things. It's really that sometimes we get to an extreme and we need to find that balance again. What does that balance look like of long-term sustainability, but also something that, you know, can really drive our society in the way that we're looking? And I think there's also a similar balance that we need to look at when it comes to feminine and masculine ways of being. And I don't mean female and male, of course, but just really, if we look at the feminine, this idea of creation, flow, versus sort of the masculine, which is like the achieving and the doing nature. I mean, as a former executive in these corporations, I would definitely say I skewed to the masculine, right? How do we get more done? How do we achieve? And it's not a linear path. And I think we're finding that due to how fast technology is advancing and how much more we're getting demanded from us and our time and our energy, we can't just keep linearly working harder, right? So what does that look like? And can we bring back some of that creativity, some of that flow, and really remove the noise, get away from those distractions, right? And start to understand again, back to that inner wisdom of, well, actually, what am I trying to do? And what do I need to focus on to just do that? And everything else falls away.
Yeah. There's so much in there that I want to poke at for a second. So one of the people who was on this podcast before was a guy named David Sachs, and we went into a deep conversation. He wrote a couple of books called The Revenge of Analog and The Future is Analog. And they're both great books and they're worth reading. But one of the areas we landed on was talking about the singularity and the future of technology and Ray Kurzweil. And David made this, I thought, really valid point, which was, and I'm really curious to know your thoughts on this. You know, tech drives forward for the sake of driving forward, right? Yes, we're trying to solve immediate kind of problems, but no one really stops being like, do we want this tech? Is it actually improving the quality of our lives? Do we actually want the singularity to occur? And if we don't, why on the earth are we, you know, spending so much money? Even if that's not necessarily the goal, that's probably the effective outcome of it. Why are we doing this? Why are we creating all sorts of technology that does not enhance the quality of our lives? In fact, in many ways, makes us subservient to the technology, not vice versa. And I'm curious to know your thoughts on that. And I'm going to ask this other question, because if I don't, I'll forget to ask it later. One of the things that intrigues me about the potential of where we are right now, excluding the singularity, but with respect to AI, is we are almost on the precipice of possibly total annihilation and extinction. But in the other direction is, you know, a post-scarcity world. And in a post-scarcity world, the desire for money and power starts to become a lot less relevant. And as far as I can tell throughout history, the driving modus operandi of humanity has been money and power. And starting to think about, like, okay, well, if that's not our motivating forces, what is it? And when I actually sat with it, it's really uncomfortable being like, fuck, I have no idea what I would be doing in a truly post-scarce world. And so two questions in that, which is, how do you feel about the sort of drive of technology as a person who was in technology? And then, you know, where do you land on what the future of AI presents?
Yeah. I mean, this is actually exactly the question I've been asking myself since I was about 8. Which is strange. That's what happens when you grow up in Silicon Valley, right? So I will actually answer them with sort of the same point. I very much believe that where we look is where we go. So I think that whatever narrative we put and wherever we decide to focus, that is what we're going to build. And I think if that's a focus on being fearful, I think we will build in exactly the direction that we fear, right? Okay. So a lot of our, you know, if research shows that 95% of our decisions are made by the unconscious, our desire to avoid things is often driving a lot of our behaviors. And so to me, having these conversations is incredibly critical. And having the conversation, like you said, to understand, well, actually, where do we want to go? What do we want to build? What is the point of this? And really shifting that so that technology is in service of humanity, right? So really kind of coming back to our humanity. And it made sense that we were trying to build forward because we wanted to create a more prosperous society, right? And so I think we lost the point of why we were building all that money and power in for short-term gains. But now we're starting to see that lift, right? And you speak to this idea of, well, now our survival needs are being met more and more across the globe. And we're getting to this point of, well, if we're past that, then what? And I think you've got escapism and then you've got this return toward humanity and sort of going inward. And I think every individual has a different motivation and journey and experience, life experience that they want to have. And so if we ask ourselves, well, what is the society that we want to see? You know, what is humanity? What is the purpose of, and what does it mean to be human in the modern world? And asking that for each of us individually and understanding who we are and what we're looking for. I think we start on that individual basis, then we will get to the collective that we want. Because at the end of the day, I think humans are actually more simple than we think we are, right? We want to believe that we're these intelligent, complex creatures. But if you look at what, you know, one thing I used to do a lot is think about when I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do, I would imagine myself at 90 years old and think about what would I be most proud of having done in my life. And by projecting forward and out, you never say like, oh, I wanted this title, I wanted this car, I wanted this thing, right? Like there's always this thought of connection, right? Like real intimacy in my relationships, like real conversations, real sense of belonging. There's a sense of having a purpose and having served back and done something or done something creative, something really bringing your gift into society and really just evolving yourself, right? And being able to experience life to its fullest. And I think if we come back to that, then it becomes very simple to say, well, actually, that those are the skills that we need to build. These are the understandings that are really critical for the modern world. How do we know, bringing back to an internal locus of control, who are we? And actually, how do we want to live our lives? And I think that's where it comes from.
That's a perfect PR segue to your latest venture. Like almost, they couldn't have defined it better. I don't know if that was conscious or unconscious, but it was very well done. One question before we get into that, which is, and this was something I was thinking about this morning, and as I'm talking to you more and more, I realize how many weird and potentially useless and random thoughts I have. The idea of bringing your gift into the world is an interesting comment, or bringing your gift to the world, which is so many people like you and me, entrepreneurs, like all the people I hang out with are doing things. And like, I think much like the people you worked with in the fashion industry, it's like focused on doing good things. Like it's motivated by, I think, genuinely positive purposes. Sure, like profit motive is part of it, but I think everyone wants to create their impact on the world and leave the world a better place than we started. And the thought I had this morning is just like, how much of that is driven by ego, which is like, why can't I just have the gift for myself? And this came up actually in the conversation of AI, which is a wonderful friend of mine, Matt Coleman. You know, he's a musician. He's a teacher primarily, but he's also a musician. And recently he was playing with an AI and asked it, you know, or his buddy was playing with AI and asked it to create, you know, surfer songs about flushing a toilet or something like that. And created songs that you could totally hear on the radio, right? Like they were that good. And he's like, music as we know it is done. And my other friend, Owen, commented, well, doesn't this create the opportunity where music can just, you know, creating music can be done just for ourselves and not for the purpose of, you know, creating music to share or anything along those lines. It gives musical creation right back to the person, because we don't need a person to create music to share anymore. And it's kind of the same thing, being like, you know, do we need to give our gift to the world? Because so many people, I feel like, are trying to give it to the world. And there's a piece of ego in that. And that may be part of the problem.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I think it comes back to sort of how and why they're doing it, right?
Yeah.
And I think giving that gift back into the world could be in a very small scale, in a very local scale, right? Just somebody who is, let's say, teachers, right? Just being able to teach is such a gift. And I think often we think about this in a very, you know, I want to be on the cover of Time and I want to be thought of as this hero that saves the world and all of that. And absolutely that's where ego comes in, right? This idea that the world needs saving. I think that is a very dangerous question or premise to be coming from. So again, like, where is that energy of what's trying to be done coming from? And which I think is different when you think about like true creatives. And when I say creative, it doesn't have to be music and what we're thinking, but just an idea, an original thought or a creation. And most of the people that I speak to that are true creatives, or even just these entrepreneurs, right, there's a fuel that is inside them that is almost like, maybe they don't even want to do it, but it's like they know that they're supposed to be working on this. They enjoy the process. It's not about the stories, the PR, the marketing, you know, and those pieces. It's really about this idea that they are so compelled from an internal fire that it's almost not an option. And that's what I think of when I think of people who have gifts, that it's almost like in spite of all the hurdles and in spite of having to live potentially in some of these cases, a very public life, that they are there because this is something that is maybe not even theirs. It's maybe just more of something flowing through them. And I think that's the kind of gift that I speak about.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I also feel like a lot of entrepreneurs are motivated by a deep, deep sense of anxiety, and somehow being successful in business is going to validate whatever's missing. And we know, I know that firsthand, that that's a failed exercise.
Oh, absolutely. Some of the most ambitious, successful people, right? It's usually insecurity driving them. And I will happily admit that a lot of my successes were from a point of needing to prove to myself that I was of value or of worth, or even just from the framing of trying to make my parents proud, that all of the work and sacrifice that they put into my sister and myself and raising us was for some result, right?
Yeah.
And
got to climb that mountain. That mountain path
that
is
mountain.
Calling you.
Exactly.
So on that note, tell us about your latest venture. And I have some insight on this because I was a happy participant in the first run of it. But tell us about Becoming, where the idea came from and what your ambition is with it.
Yeah. So Becoming has been, I guess, right, very much in the word. It was this idea that we're always becoming. We're always on this journey. We're not, there is no finish line and idea of being done. So in this pursuit of just living life and being very honest with ourselves about the fact that we're continually figuring it out, I felt in one part very fortunate that I had met a lot of really amazing experts, had, you know, various different experiences that made parts of my life much easier. And when I was at Estee Lauder, it was during COVID that we were, you know, like everybody, the world was changing, and these conversations about mental health and how we navigate change and this massive amounts of change were very topical. And it was through that that it became very clear to me that this challenge around sort of mental and emotional health, resilience, and just performing, but performing in a way where you're balancing out with well-being, it's a very personal journey. There is no one size fits all when it comes to how to live life. And so I wanted to figure out, is there a way that you can take all these different experts who understand all these different aspects of life, everything from sleep and nutrition, but also to actually what is it that blocks us when it comes to living the way we want to live? And what is it that helps us understand what is a distraction and actually what is meaningful to us earlier in life? Because why do we have to wait until we get to 80 and are wise and say, oh gosh, yeah, now if I knew all this, I would do this differently.
Yeah.
And so the thought was actually, how do we amplify, again, these gifts that all these different experts around the world have and make it accessible to not just the wealthiest people and not just the top athletes or the Olympians in the world, but when you look at anybody who is successful, there's a team behind them. So how do we bring that same aspect? And do it in a way, though, that is very practical, because my engineering side says, look, this is all great and well, but frankly, I have a life to live and I have a lot of things to do and a lot of responsibilities. So how do I synthesize this and make it relevant to a person? So, you know, after 2 years of very active development, we really worked on how do we create, you know, we ultimately came up with a 6-week program that starts with assessments that understands, well, where are you in your own journey? And bringing you on a 4-day retreat and then having a reintegration with a coach that then helps to bring it into your life. But how do we create shifts for you? How do we help you understand actually what are the one or two things that you can shift and focus on that will actually give you the most uplift and allow you to really live in more alignment with who you are?
Right.
And so that was really the premise.
And what was your perspective on the first go round in Portugal?
I mean, with anything, right? Anybody who has built a product or anything, you learn and you iterate and you learn and you iterate. And by the time we did our first run through, we had done a lot of initial tests, but this was the first time we brought it all together with people who were not familiar with the pieces in the program. I have to say, I think I was actually quite surprised at how much happened in the four-day retreat itself, and how I think we learned a lot about what exactly is really unlocking things for people. And we started focusing more on this unconscious piece and this idea around, I would say, limiting beliefs, really kind of three areas. So beliefs, skills, and rituals. And we look at sort of those pillars and we start to say, okay, where, if these, we had, you know, 10 different people, very different personality. We purposely picked people who were, you know, I would say all similar in that they are successful driven people in the world, but where they live, what they do, their life experience is purposely different. And to me, it was that there can be these profound shifts that happen when you understand, we call it metacognition, but effectively, you know, what is the fastest way to change is this idea of if you think about your thinking processes and you start to really connect back in with your body. And I think we are such a intellectual knowledge, cerebral society, and bringing people back to their bodies and helping them understand sort of actually what are they feeling and what does that mean? Right. And what do they do with that? And then most importantly, how you feel, how you think, that's not who you are. That's not these things that we hold on to as our identity is often not our identity. They're just things that we, mental models, their thinking traps, their things that we've learned, maybe even picked up that are not really our own ideas, right? It's just from our environments. And so if we can start to sort of unhook those and start to look at them in a way and understand, actually, that's not part of me. I don't need to be carrying this around. And I don't need to fear this. I don't need to feel guilt about this. I don't need to feel shame about this. In fact, if anything, a lot of these things become actually superpowers that actually propel us into becoming more resilient and stronger people. It's those things that we start to understand are actually what makes us uniquely us. And if we can really let go of a lot of these things, that's actually where the growth comes.
Yeah. And have you gone through these exercises yourselves, and where did you come out the other side?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, this is something I would say that I've been unofficially doing for the last 20 years,
yeah,
which is sort of how it became designed. But certainly, I mean, as you know, I had quite a few things happen to me actually the week before we launched.
Yes.
And I just thought, thank you, world. You have literally just thrown me into the fire, which is very much the way I've always lived. Right. But, what was it? The week before we were all going to Portugal for this launch, what I found out, I was going to move in with my boyfriend. We were going to have kids. I had done fertility testing. He had a change of heart, but didn't let me know.
And oh, so shit. All I didn't know
all,
that.
Yeah. So all I knew was, his parents, apparently freaked out, about this idea, 'cause I was not from his culture. So he was navigating that and didn't know how to tell me. So what he did tell me was, what he told me was, I'm going to have to find another place to live after asking me to move in and getting rid of my apartments. So I was 5 days away from having sold all my stuff here in the US. I had an apartment in London he asked me to get rid of. I had just gotten rid of it. And yeah, I had no home. So in 5 days, I was like, and this is during like the holidays, right? It's Jan 1's coming up pretty hot and heavy. And I'm like, wait a second, I have no place to live.
Yep.
Everybody's pretty much offline. I don't even know which country I'm going to live in. Am I still going back to London? Am I staying in the US? My relationship seems to have blown up. So a lot of grief around, well, I thought I was literally on this path to having a family. I mean, we had talked about all this stuff. There was plans in place. And now what does that mean? And then 3 days later, I find out I have cancer, and there's no history of cancer in my family. I'm like very boring and healthy. So we were all quite shocked. And I thought, you know, what was crazy is when I found out that it was a very tough week, as you can imagine. But when I found out I had the cancer, there was this huge weight that lifted off. And it was actually the most liberating moment I have felt in my life. And I think what happened was I thought, got it, universe. I was on a path that is not a got it. Like, it's the wrong path. Like, I just need to surrender. And everything I was working toward was not meant for me. And I definitely still had to grieve. I really allowed myself to feel the emotions of that. And I am usually not like that. Being an executive, I learned how to be very stoic. And so my personal learnings was, I was very good at being mentally resilient and understanding the bigger picture and logically understanding that this is what it is. Let's get up, move on, and you know, find a path that always ends up better. But my body, I usually didn't let my body go through the process. So I had a lot of, you know, stored grief or anger about different situations. And I said, you know what, one thing I learned from my own program was that we don't give ourselves the time to actually, and the grace to say, it's okay to be sad. It's okay to be upset about this.
Yeah.
And that does not make me weak. This is just a process that the human body needs to go through. And let's just let it go through that. So I allowed myself to cry a lot. And that was when I realized that the grief was around this idea of having a family more than, like, obviously the situation itself, realizing, well, this was probably not the right relationship if this is where it ended up. However, that doesn't stop sort of that disappointment from here's a life I thought I was going to lead. And so when I found out about the cancer and I said, okay, got it. Like, it's not even a question about what can I live that life? Actually, that forced me to stay in the US, start getting treatment right away. And here's where it gets even crazier. And my friends all know that I see this cancer as a gift because it's really propelled me into, that's not saying it's a gift for everyone. I'm just saying for me very personally in this situation, here's where it gets crazier and crazier is I have cancer and it's a very specific type. And then it turned out to be stage 4, but because it was stage 4, there's one standard treatment and there's no chemo, no surgery, none of this. They actually put me into medically induced menopause. And I said, wait a second. So you're telling me I have cancer and you're putting me into menopause. So now the universe is telling me there's not a question of, am I going to naturally have kids in the next year? Like, I don't even have to worry about that. Like, that's actually like this huge relief sort of taken off my like plate of, well, but I should, because I still can. So I should be doing that. And I should be pushing toward this. And suddenly there was this release of, wait a second, like, let me start to ask myself, well, is that what I wanted? You know, I had talked about having surrogates. I had talked about like all this sort of stuff. And my friends reminded me, and it's like, wait, did I lose kind of like how I was thinking about designing my life? And let me come back to it. And sort of the life and the world just gave me that. And as my friends also, secondly, gave me a book called The Wisdom of Menopause, written by this doctor. And as I was reading it, it was explaining to me that moving into menopause, there's something that happens with our reproductive hormones that actually signals to our brain to suppress our own needs in support of society and caretaking. Mm. And so by actually moving into this medically induced menopause, I have fast-tracked myself into being aligned with my own soul's desires. And that's what is written in this medical book. And I just thought, this is crazy. So I literally have built this company that is trying to get us back to that clarity of our human existence at the same time that I've literally thrown myself in the fire to say, we're going to be living it.
So for everyone listening, it's like I spoke to Florence, I think the day after you got the diagnosis, because we were preparing to go to Portugal, and it was a lead up call for the first becoming retreat. And I'm sure for everyone listening, you can pick up Florence's very lovely and positive energy that she carries. And she walked into the conversation. We're chatting. I'm talking about what's going on. And I'm probably complaining about some of the insignificant trivialities in my life. And she's like, oh, yeah. And I just found out I have cancer. And I was like, what? But just the levity that you bring to this whole conversation. Because you also went out and got a puppy recently, right?
I did. How is the dog? Oh my God, he's so good. I've learned so much about looking at life in a very different way. He's so playful. And that's one of the reasons I thought he would be very fun to get. Plus I decided to travel less this year. I just realized I want more play in my life. I want kind of more of this. And I was like, let's continue to design my life in the way that it would really bring me the most joy. And it's so interesting, right? And there might be other people out there who've had this similar idea. There's nothing like this reality of a disease or death or something bigger. It doesn't have to be that, but just something bigger being like, what's important in life? Yeah, and it's just actually that clarity is just so beautiful because it's like, got it. Like the noise goes away and things that may normally bother you just kind of fall by the wayside because you go, actually, I'm really happy. Like, this is great. And let's make these changes today. And I think you start to see things in such a different way. And yeah I just can't, I honestly can't imagine anything better, which I know has got to sound strange to a lot of people, but I could not be happier.
Yeah. I think anybody listening can hear the sincerity in your voice. And at the same time, like I probably had more anxiety about your diagnosis than you did. And you know, that's like, that's something that I'm in awe, like truly in awe about how you're managing that. Cause like, I know I would have been this is now a good long podcast, and I thought it'd be very interesting to have you on because it's a conversation about how to live a good long life. And someone who's just been given a stage 4 cancer diagnosis as the first episode, I thought was like, okay, let's mm-hmm. make this a real conversation. Mm-hmm. Would be a great way to start the dialogue about like, this is like, life is complex. And,
life is complex.
As Tom Robbins says, like, give me life, all of life, the miserable as well as the superb. And as much as I like to believe I could do that, like, there was a previous episode that I did last summer with a relative of mine who was telling a story about how her husband and the father of their 1-year-old daughter had cancer, and, you know, had cancer. It went away. Then it came back, and within 7 weeks, he was dead. And, you can listen to it. Like, I have trouble just hearing her story. Now I have trouble hearing her story because her husband was the same age as me. And so there's a lot of like, oh, that cuts very close to home, and you're about the same age as me. And so it cuts very close to home. And I just have so much respect for how you're like, okay, like, let's roll it. Like, this is a gift. And I don't know how you do that. Can you teach me the secret of that, please? Because I wish, like, I mean, you know, we talked about genetics and our upbringing and all that kind of stuff, and Jewish neuroticism and Jewish anxiety. I have a whole post written or a solo cast ready to go about that, because, like, you know, I bought an ultra human ring, and then I just I see you have an aura ring, and I found like, this thing just causes more anxiety. It's like, you know, I'm reading someone named Michael Easter who's like, buy a wearable, get some insights, stop wearing it, right? Like, that's kind of what you should be doing. And I'm like, it causes more anxiety. But why did I get it? Because like, I wanted to feel like I had some control over my health and what's going on inside of my body. Sure. And I'm realizing that, well, that's flipped. I actually don't want control of things. I'll eat well, I'll sleep well, I'll exercise. And after that, it's like, I don't want that control. I don't need that level of granularity, because Jewish anxiety and Jewish neuroticism kicks right in. And it's like, it's built into my DNA somehow. And I wish I could shift it. And so I look at you with, hopefully to learn from how you're navigating all of this. Like, when you told me you got a dog too, I was just like, what the? That's awesome. But like,
who does this? I know.
Yeah.
Like, but I love your point around it, but it's about knowing yourself, right? And like you said, you know how you'll respond to certain things, and then you make it easier for yourself, right? So, you know, a great example is there's certain foods that I love, but I know if I have them in my house, I will just eat the whole thing, like almost, you know, like without thought. And I was like, okay, well, let's make this easier. Let's not put them in my house because I don't need them. I don't want, you know, so obviously that's a very simple example, but it's sort of, you know, that I think helps all of us just figure out like, how do we make our everyday lives easier? And I think, you know, when it comes to cancer, I think for me, there's what I've learned a lot about not only just cancer, but sort of everything in life, is that there's certain words that we ascribe good or bad, right? This sort of like stage 4 label makes it sound like, oh my God.
Yeah.
And cancer, there's so many different types of cancer. Like, it doesn't mean the same thing. And then you start to like, I ask myself, well, what does that really mean? Like, you know, you could get hit by a bus the next day. You could have, you know, like there's all these other kind of diseases, right? You could have, these massive breakups. You could go through a divorce. There's so many things that happen in life. And I think the clarity I have now is that all you can do is live your days as much aligned to how you want to live them. And that's really going to give you the best life experience, right? And I think not having those regrets, because I have followed and continue to, as I learn, I don't always figure it out immediately, obviously. And I fall back into some of those same things, but just realizing all of these things are just different mechanisms to help us navigate as we learn. And so for me, this doesn't really, the word itself can be scary, but it doesn't have the significance, I guess, that some people put to it, right? And it depends on people's experiences as well. So for me, what does it mean? It means clarity. It gave me much, I probably would have you know, continued to try to go down this other path of trying to have a family with this other person. And that wouldn't have worked out. So it's just, it really is sort of, what do you make of different things? What does it allow for you? And sort of, where do you take it next? And to me, that's what anything is. And the impermanence of everything is actually quite poignant. So it doesn't mean, to me, it's not a label. It's not who I am. It's just another aspect of my life that requires a different level of understanding and navigation. But that's everything. That's having kids. That's having a dog. That's having to move. That's having all of this. And some of these we choose, some of them we don't. I did joke with people. I said, you know what? I love experiencing different things because of how much I get to learn. And I just enjoy new experiences. But I'm pretty sure if you asked me to fill out a checklist of what I was going to experience in this lifetime, I don't think I would have checked the cancer box, but thank God it's not all in my decision-making, because I think the best things that have happened to me are things that I would have never picked for myself.
Yeah. I loved last time we spoke, you talked about how it's just something like you managed like diabetes, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely. And you're also talking about dating, and I'm curious to know, have you gone on a date recently, and have you brought up the conversation, and how did people respond?
Yeah. So one of my favorite things about this diagnosis is actually that I have such deep faith in humanity since getting it. Not only have I taken the unique path of actually just deciding to tell people and being very open about it, which has now garnered so many people saying, yeah, actually my so-and-so and this and this and this have all had it and successfully gone through. It reminds me of my girlfriends who had miscarriages, and everybody had the stigma around saying it. And then it turns out it's actually very common.
Yeah.
And so I think part of what I would love to see in society is our ability to actually share these, you know, quote unquote, difficult or like suffering or things that are just unexpected or unknown, because I think having such a deeply caring network and individuals who can share their experiences with you just makes it so much easier. So that's definitely one thing that some people said, well, you should really keep it to yourself. And I thought about it and I said, is this something that I want to? And I thought, that's not ever how I've been. I've learned so much by sharing so much, because then people can share their knowledge with me. And so that was something that has made this beautiful. And in the same way, so I just started dating again. And what has been really interesting is I joked about it. I was like, you know, is it first conversation, first date conversation? Like, hey, tell me about yourself. I was like, well, so,
let's get into it.
Yeah. So I live in Miami, have stage 4 cancer. I work at this, and, you know, just like, do I just slip it in there and see if they like look at me? And for the most part, it just naturally comes up at a certain point, especially since one of the things I do is I'm very strict about not eating sugar. And often they ask me, they said, is this just like a preference, or is this something that is, you know, like basically why? And the first time I was asked, I thought, okay, do I say, because I am pretty healthy, like, but like the real reason I have to be so strict and like ask the waiters is because of the cancer. So I was like, you know what, I'm just going to say it. And so far, the way every guy has responded is just so, they're just so able to be just real and empathetic and just, well, how does that feel? How are you? What is that, you know, and really, and they've asked me out again. So I think it doesn't seem to be a deal breaker, which actually, very honestly, I was, you know, I'm very open to the fact of, I'm not sure people would want to date somebody who has stage 4, right? For various different reasons. But it so far I've not run into anybody who has been a deal breaker for. And I think that right there just starts to show that people are ready for just real conversations about real life, and the fact that it's not always so simple and it's not always straightforward and we don't always know what's going to happen. All we know is that this is what we have today.
Yeah. And that's particularly like surprising living in Miami too, that people are real. But you know, I really appreciate the point that like maybe the responses you're getting are an indication that notwithstanding everything to the that you see in the media to the contrary, maybe we are as a species starting to grow up a little bit. And actually gives me a lot of hope.
Yeah. Well, and I think that almost every person I have shared this with knows multiple people who have gone through something like this, and the majority of them very much surviving stage four. So I think our modern medicine is really quite incredible. And this is something, you know, I was preparing myself for who knows what's going to happen. And the doctors are very bullish. And I said, well, great. That's even better. Like, great. Because I have a lot of things that I want to do. As you know, I'm very passionate about this work that I'm doing. I do believe it's the reason I'm in here in this lifetime. And it is the thing that I'm supposed to be sharing. And I have an amazing team that is propelling it forward no matter what happens. So it's sort of neither here nor there to me as to kind of how it unfolds, as long as it creates impact. But what was great is they were like, yep, we think it'll be good. And I was like, great. Well, I'm like, I'm right there with you. I agree. I feel like I'm going to live a very long time.
That's wonderful. So in preparing for this conversation, one of the things I usually do, because one of my biggest fears is I'm going to run out of things to talk about. So I over prepare and then usually it's never a problem. But I always troll people online, or not troll people. I stalk people online to see what they've said on Twitter, on Instagram, and all that kind of stuff, just as conversation fodder if I ever need it. But you're not anywhere online, which made it particularly hard. So I walked in, this was the totality of my notes. Walking into this conversation, which are very limited, but you're not online. And why is that?
I'm not. Yeah. Well, good. So I've done a good job of keeping it limited. Yeah. So actually, you know, it's really interesting because I very highly enjoy my privacy. And so it's been really interesting with this work, as people have been asking me to tell my story. And I was like, oof, do I really have to? Like, I'm happy to tell anybody sort of in more private forums. And people were like, no, I really think that this is something that people would find accessible, or, you know, could be helpful. And I said, okay. But really, I was sort of in my teens and sort of early college years, I started getting more visibility. I had a modeling agency in Paris while I was there in pastry school. This was my first
in pastry school. Hold on.
Yeah. So I quit my job at BMW. Korean mom freaked out. Like, we sent you to Harvey Mudd, very expensive top engineering school in the US, got a dream job. I love cars, designing concept cars. 2 years in, I quit. And my mom's like, what are you doing? And I'm not a rebellious person, but at the time I was having these crazy migraines, didn't know what it was. I did all these tests, elimination diets. I was living in, you know, Venice Beach. So everybody's very aware of sort of nutrition. And this is when I learned about processed foods, and they thought I had to be gluten-free. So I didn't even know what an entrepreneur was. I was like, did a year of research. I said, okay, I want to build a gluten-free business, but not everybody's going to have this. So it has to be distribution. So let's do a distribution business in maybe through Whole Foods, all this sort of stuff. But I didn't know, I couldn't figure out a way to make really good bread. So I was like, let me go to Paris. Went to Cordon Bleu there to learn how they make them so that I can work with my alternative flours. As I was doing that, of course, I needed money to maintain my life. Yeah. It turns out you need to know French, to work in France. Yeah. I know. Shocking. Shocking. So it was like, my options are the American or like British bars or modeling. And I was like, well, I don't love the idea of working like late night at bars. It's not really my vibe. So I joined this modeling agency and I started doing this and I started getting a little bit more visibility, and there became this like kind of crossroads of like, well, am I going to go into my modeling career? By the way, I was terrible, but they were really trying. So, you know, they literally said, my head of the agency says, I'm sorry, you're American, Korean raised, and Catholic. this is literally the, they're like, you're competing with Eastern Europeans. Like, we're screwed. Like, you're such a prude. You don't like being topless. And I was like, oh my God. So yeah, anyway, naturally, I don't think it would have worked out for me, but I was at this crossroads and I was like, frankly, I'm so much more interested in the entrepreneurial route. I'm going this way. But as this happened, I was starting to get more and more visibility. And so some of my shoots had come out and there was a guy that saw some of my pictures and I guess had asked to be, he was a friend of a friend or sort of in my network from my hometown and asked to be introduced to me when I got back from Paris. So here I am in the Bay Area. We go on some dates and everything seems sort of fine. I'm busy with my work, things progress. And basically turns out he had been stalking me, found those pictures. I didn't know anything about that. I just thought he was introduced to me. Turns out there was this whole backstory where he stalked me for about 4 months, pretended to be this person that he thought that I would like. He'd, you know, gotten into all my emails and things like that, read the history of different things to figure out who he needed to pretend to be. So obviously, I mean, this is like a movie. Then he ended up basically kidnapping me for about 5 months.
What?
Yep. Super crazy, threatening my family, doing all this stuff. And so like I was so naive, didn't really understand, tried to run away multiple times. You know, at some point I realized like if I don't have evidence to him kind of holding me and sort of, so there's a lot of physical abuse as part of it to keep me there. And so I remember going through it and I was like, okay, literally I can get through anything. I can get through this. I can get through anything. I was like, this is going to make me such a strong person. And I was like, okay, now I just have to figure out what's my exit strategy. And, when I finally escaped, I, you know, 2 days later got back to work, was so excited to be back in life, just kind of got on with it. The state of California gave me a year's worth of therapy. So that was kind of the first time I got into trying to talk about it. And, you know, what's interesting, Ronan, is that my therapist said that I spent the entire year talking about how to help other people understand what happened to me. Hmm. So many other people did not respond well to what happened to me. And there was a lot of sort of blame. How could you do this? And so right. There was a lot of like very confusing sort of dealing with things. Cause I think at the end of the day, I finally realized that they wanted to protect me and felt like they couldn't protect me. So their way of dealing with it was to put it back on me and say, well, you must've wanted to be in that situation, which as you can imagine is not what anybody wants to hear, but I digress. So basically after this experience, I took everything off of any form of social media. I wasn't even on LinkedIn for quite some time. And obviously in hiding, the guy went to jail, all of these sorts of things, but, you know, got a lifetime restraining order against him, all these things. But after that, I was very, very prizing my anonymity. And I was like, I'm just going to live my life, do my thing, but I don't need anybody to know who I am. So, yep.
Cancer, kidnapping. You really choose those mountain paths, don't you? Jesus. That's crazy. So but true. Yeah. Wow.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah, it's not been a boring life, but see back to this thing of like, sometimes it feels like we take things too seriously. It's just, yeah, I think life can be very, very much like a movie sometimes. And I talk to people and every time I share something, you start to realize people have had such interesting, crazy experiences and we just don't always feel like we can talk about them, right? Because there's a lot of judgment, I think, that comes with it. I think I was, some of my colleagues, had, there was a moment where we were doing some sort of team development or team sharing. And, you know, this is later on in my career, right? So I'm pretty high up at a very large company at this point. And, you know, they asked me to share something and this is the story I shared. And I think people said, well, I would have never guessed that yeah. You were kidnapped for 5 months and beaten. And, you know, like I have so people find out because I have a scar on my right leg where the guy cut my leg open. And they're Jesus. Like, oh, did you fall? And I was like, not quite. And they just look at me like stunned. And I remember in this you know, sharing this with my executives. And I mean, they were incredibly, incredibly, as you can imagine, very just heartwarming and thoughtful and very kindly receiving this. But the biggest thing they said is, I would have never guessed. And I was like, well, why would you? I mean, like, it's not, again, cancer, kidnappings, sort of all these sort of different things that happen to us. They are not who we are, you know, and they're just part of our story.
So. They're not who we are. They're how we learn, I suppose, right?
Yeah. They're just part of the journey.
Yeah. You asked me before, why am I rebooting the podcast? And listening to you talk right now actually reminded me of why I do it. One is I find these conversations very cathartic. There's been more than one podcast where I'm in tears. And a little bit of a sidebar, but you know, for me, I'm very much like you in that, like I'm very good at intellectualizing things and not very good at translating into like intense emotion, which is why that experience with Carol at Becoming and the Rage Practice was awesome. And, she's great. And I'm going to have her on the podcast. But the other reason, and so, you know, through these experiences, these conversations, it gives me an opportunity to kind of get out of my head and into my body. And then the other reason is like permission, right? The brand essence at Field Trip was permission, giving people permission to lean into psychedelics, to be psychedelic, to be weird, to be whatever. That's what we stood for, being like, let's be weird. And you have the permission. And that's also the purpose of this podcast, is for a lot of guys, you know, in particular, the Scott Galloway episode, I had so many people reach out being like, thank you. Cause there's a lot of guys, like in the whole narrative of the world right now, you know, a lot of men feel left out, excluded, you know, all that kind of stuff. And what Scott shared in that, like, gave a lot of men permission to be like, oh yeah, okay, I get it. You know, that's how I feel too. And I'm not weird. And so, you know, giving people permission, and in many ways, your conversation right now, it gives people a lot of permission too, right?
And I do want to say something on that, which is, you know, I took on a lot of kind of the masculine traits being an executive, right? And playing that sort of part. And so I really resonate with, I think how, I don't know how this is going to be perceived by people, but really, I really resonate with a lot of men who I don't feel like have an outlet to express things, because there is a lot of societal pressure to seem like everything's okay, to be stoic. And it's completely unfair. I think there's so much shame, guilt, anger that ends up building up, and, you know, we're the hardest on ourselves. And I absolutely felt those things, right? It's like, well, you know, would I not be successful if people knew this about me? Right. And it's like, wait, what did I do? I tried to make money on the side to, you know, live my dream of building this business. So all I did was try to model and make some side money. And like, what it ended up happening is, I got into this terrible instance, got kidnapped, I got physically abused, and somehow I took the responsibility of that. I was like, well, I didn't figure out that he was crazy. I was too naive. This was like somehow, and it's so interesting that even people who meant well, like, we don't know always how to support people in these hard times, right? And that's one of the other pieces, is we need to help people be able to say these things and not judge them and not say, well, you know, and not put our own uncomfort into it, not put the fact that, like, I feel bad that you went through this, therefore I need to protect myself from feeling my responsibility. So I'm going to say that you chose this, you did this, right? And so how do we really open up the dialogue and say, we don't need to be so hard on ourselves. There's no reason to feel shame or guilt of things that happen, whether or not we have some responsibility or not to them. They are just parts of our lives, and we take from them what we will, and we learn from them. And it's just part of being human.
Yeah. And you should be departing for Marrakesh very soon, shouldn't you?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Indeed. Indeed. Yep. Getting back on the horse.
Yeah. For round two of the Becoming. What are your hopes and expectations for this go around?
Yeah. So I think, you know, we've got this one, we've got, We've got one in UK coming up in August as well. I think for these, it's really, I mean, the team and I, we think about it as very much just, it has to be impactful for each individual. So how do we continue to make it feel just really special and really distilling, continuing to refine and distill the program so that it really feels like something that is very approachable and something they can share back.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, I think that's all I wanted to cover. Is there anything, wisdom for a good long life, that we haven't touched on that you'd like to share before I send you back to your puppy and your day?
Just that I think we take life too seriously.
Fuck yeah.
I think I realize as I get older, everything is just funny. When they told me the diagnosis, the women, there was these three amazing women there with me in the room, and I was completely oblivious. They had me do all these tests again. You know, it had been misdiagnosed twice. So, you know, there was just no expectation of this. And so then the woman says, she said, this is not a cyst. This is cancer. And my response was, wait, really? And I just remember laughing. I was like, what is strange? I was really quite shocked. And then, you know, like I felt my eyes well up a bit and I was like, oh my gosh, like this is a real thing. Yeah. And then my thought process went to, actually, I was like, we're in Miami. I was like, wait a second. If I have to have a mastectomy, does that mean that I would get a free boob job? Like, does that mean that basically, I don't have to worry about my breast sagging? And they just started laughing. And I was like, no, this is a serious question. Because I was like, you know what? There's got to be a silver lining out of this. There's got to be something. And I was like, if I'm going to be anywhere, I feel like Miami is a perfect place to do this. And we just had such a good laugh. And I was just so deeply, I was like, you know what? If that's what's meant to be in the cards, that's what's meant to be in the cards. Now, thank God, turns out like I don't have to have a mastectomy. But it was like moments like that that I reflect on, and I was like, what, who am I? Like, why is that where my mind went? And I just thought, like, this is actually one of the, I thought back to, this is how my parents are. Like, right. Just nothing is that serious. Like, yeah. it's just, you never know what's going to happen. And life's just funny. Like, it just doesn't have to be the serious thing that we think it is. So yeah. That's my last one.
No, that's beautiful. You know, we live in denial. We're all going to live. We're all going to die. Those are the only truths. And, you know, we emerge from dream soup. We go back into dream soup in the middle. We just are. And it's, we take it too seriously. I, like I said, I love to say, like, life is too serious to take that seriously. And, you know, in some ways I live it, and in some ways, particularly in this conversation, I don't know that I'd live it. I think I'd take it fucking serious. And I just love the way that you're handling it, and I have a lot of respect for it. And I think anyone who's listening to this, you know, take a lesson here. There's a good one in here, whether you can embody it or not. Try to. I think that's a good piece of advice.
Well, we're all, I think, learning.
Yeah.
And the puppy is definitely my biggest mentor these days.
Indeed. Awesome. All right. Well, we'll stop there. Florence, thank you. That was awesome. Appreciated the conversation. It was cerebral. It was heartfelt. It was perfect.